full house here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
We're going to change the order just a little bit and take the general services first today, like the old days.
So,
is it my bias as being a former secretary? Partly, I'm going to admit that. I do have a particular appreciation for how it used to be. And so, but no, more so that there are a number of visitors here wearing the black shirts in the back. So we didn't want them to wait the 3 hours or so that it takes to get through the Board of Public Works. I think I have a record of about 3 hours, so we'll see if we can top that. So with that, I guess we'll take the Secretary's agenda and then go to DGS. But I'll turn to the Treasurer and Comptroller for opening statement. Oh, I want to say thank you for your service. Happy Veterans Day. This is passed.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Well, thank you, Governor. Governor.
I know we're around each other so much. You started looking like after a while.
Well, congratulations on your election and Governor Hogan's. Obviously, I want to reach out to all of the winning candidates at the state level, Attorney General Frosch and Senator Cardin. The federal level, our congressional delegation, and also all the new and returning members of the legislature and candidates for the county offices. I look forward to working with each of the newly elected officials to advance the priorities that matter to their communities and to our entire state. I think it's also important that we recognize not only the winners, but the losers, people that went out and knocked on doors for months, tried to get either local or county or state seat. Theodore Roosevelt famously talked about how people who enter the arena, winners or losers, deserve our respect and praise. So I want to give my personal admiration for those who were willing to engage in our political process and put forward their vision to make Maryland a better place. And I'd also like to follow up, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, on your comment about veterans. And I think it's important that we recognize veterans who served our country. Just like our politicians served the state, our veterans in Maryland served our country. Growing up, my father used to speak about his time in World War II, and as a U.S. Army veteran myself, I'm constantly reminded of the importance of keeping our attention toward those who are currently serving both at home and overseas. This weekend's Veterans Day observances commemorated the countless generations of men and women who have dedicated their lives to protecting and defending our country and our freedoms, whether it was a few days or a few decades ago. We must never forget that we are the land of the free because of the brave, and it is incumbent upon us as citizens, a grateful nation, to ensure that our veterans receive the care and services they need after serving our country with valor and distinction. And I remember the phrases I saw over the weekend where people said, don't thank us for our service. Better say to us, we will never forget. Thank you for reminding me of that. And if I could, just personal note, wish everybody a great Thanksgiving celebration. I think our next board meeting is
after
the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday. It happens to be my favorite.
Mine too. I love Thanksgiving.
I was actually
and boring. I get upset the fact that, you know, we just skip over Thanksgiving, go right to Christmas, right after Halloween, and sometimes before Halloween.
I knew there was something Governor Hogan and I liked.
No, Governor Hogan.
Sorry, I apologize.
I know, we look so much alike. Well, also you mentioned with Veterans Day, and I don't want to steal your thunder, but Veterans Day, that Sunday we also were commemorating the 100th anniversary of the armistice being signed on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. And so the war to end all wars, the Great War.
Yeah. Yes. So many of us were, a few of us didn't want to go out and get wet, but the less thought given to that. But I would just like to echo, which I don't do often, the comptroller. Congratulations to all of those who were involved in the public debate, whether as candidates or working, going door to door, getting out the vote. A tremendous number of people voted. It was one of the few times I enjoy standing in line. And it was just, I think, a terrific day. I happened to be on 11/11 at Arlington. And it was very interesting. As you know, my parents are both buried there. But what was exciting was all the young people, or all the people of different ages who were there, I think probably because they made a special point of the 100th anniversary. But there were people in all parts of Arlington, people, different races, different ages, some of them from pretty far away, all focused on concern, actually, when you talk to them, about peace in our time. And it was really a very, very encouraging and uplifting day. And I just urge everybody, if you have any time, it's a beautiful place, and there are a lot of beautiful people there. And with that, thank you. Go ahead. Thank you.
Well, I think we'll go with the Secretary's agenda and then General Secretary's.
Okay. Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. We have 26 items on the Secretary's agenda. 3 reports of emergency procurements. We are withdrawing item 8, which is a wetlands recommendation, and we'll come back at a later meeting.
I have one question, and it's 13. The removal of the dam. Is that pronounced bloaty or blood?
Bloaty.
Bloaty. That's what I said. Mark? Now, I understand it was already taken down.
It was.
And what's this funding for?
I'm going to call up Perry Otwell. He is the head of our DNR Engineering and Construction to give you much more details.
How you doing? Perry Otwell, Director of Engineering and Construction for DNR. The expense is due to ongoing changes. The dam is not completely removed. It's majority removed. It tends to be done sometime in April. The expense is typically due to differing rock conditions. During the design, they took soil borings, but they didn't take quite enough. And in some places, where they did soil borings within 10 foot of where we were working, the rock conditions greatly changed. Basically, the density of rock went from, I really don't know the density, but it's about 4 times the density. So when they came out with coring drills, instead of doing, 2 to 3 feet an hour, they were sitting there doing 2 to 3 minutes, so they had to remobilize, get new coring drills, different bits. But that was the majority of the expense.
Okay. When was it first built?
First built?
Roughly. You don't have to give exact.
Back in the 1920s.
Okay. And what type of stone did they use then?
What's that?
What type of stone did they use?
It was concrete.
Oh, it was concrete.
But the stone is within the Patapsco River.
The riverbed.
Yeah,
okay.
The main problem with working is the Patapsco River. Uh-huh. And the differing rock conditions are the difference between boulders and bedrock. So you can drill 10 feet to one side, drill through a 40-ton boulder, but then you hit bedrock and the density totally changes. That's the majority of it. We're into, right now, the Howard County Bonnie Branch Interceptor Line, where we're digging that over, and that bedrock was determined to be 8 foot lower than they anticipated on the plans. So that's a change order we have.
How do you more take this sounding? I mean, what equipment do you use to take the soundings?
They don't do soundings. We're coring through the rock. We have,
so you don't do any sort of LIDAR or any?
No. No, it's what? All. Well, that type of surveying really isn't appropriate for this type of operation. We're doing subsurface exploration,
right,
where we're core drilling, you know, sometimes 20, 25 feet through rock. And when they were core drilling on the Grist Mill Trail, for example, they core drilled where the sewer was going to be, but due to inaccurate as-builts, the sewer was in a different place. So when we shifted over, we found bedrock at a different elevation, and everything is based on cubic feet of removal of the rock. And it's greatly gone up. Yeah. I mean, the cost is still what I anticipated. You know, we started out $16.5 million. I expected about 20% change orders just from the unpredictable nature of the Patapsco River and the conditions that the design was done under.
Yeah.
I mean, we've had $300,000 just in storm damage related costs or change orders.
Yeah, a lot more water than what we have had.
Yeah, I mean, right now, the last Bonnie Branch, we're trying to put in a sewer line 22 feet below the river. So we'll be doing that with divers. We could not directional drill it due to the locations of rock outcroppings. So we're basically stuck open trenching, blasting, and installing the line with divers.
All right. Well, I can talk to DNR. I'm just interested. It's a lot more complicated than just taking down a dam structure.
The dam structure alone would have been a lot easier, but we relocated a 48-inch force main.
Okay.
That was running parallel to the river and through the dam.
Got it. Okay. Well, thank you very much. And I just want to say one more thing about Department of Natural Resources. The fact that your secretary was able to fit into his military uniform on Sunday was quite impressive.
We were all very proud. Yes. Thank you. I'll pass the message along.
Okay. I have another question. This is Department of Planning, the Historic Trust. No one needs to come up for this, but I wanted to point out this is the Easton Armory and Waterfowl Building. I think, Comptroller, you were there this weekend for the Waterfowl Festival. I was there on Saturday on a windy, cold day. But I did go into the armory, which I've been into several times, where they use it for displays. In this case, it was the Waterfowl Festival, so a lot of artwork as well as crafts associated with waterfowl. And so it was a wonderful weekend on the shore, and particularly at the armory. And I know they have a need for the fact that the windows are starting to fail there. So I don't know if you want to say anything about those.
Yeah, no, I was there on a windy, rainy day on Friday. But it's a great festival. I encourage everybody to go. It's a three-day festival around this time of the year. And Easton, Maryland really puts on quite a show. 2 years from now will be their 50th Easton Waterfowl Festival.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that the state helps them and partners with them to attract more people. They already attract 7,000 to 10,000 visitors from around the country and around the region. But the 50th is going to be special, and I certainly enjoy walking and seeing the Easton Armory. I agree with you. I think the windows, that's a great project, and happy to be supportive of this.
Since we're doing show and tell in this district, I happened to be in that area last week doing a tour of Easton Utilities, which was fascinating. And I noticed on 15 in item 15 in Frederick County, the photovoltaic project. Well, they're doing photovoltaics also in Easton, a wonderful project where they actually become, the utility plant becomes self-sustaining, and which is the direction I think that your Climate Change Commission, Governor, is going to be taking us whenever possible. What used to be called appropriate technology So many places in our state, either with photovoltaics or with geothermal, are taking the site on site and doing what they can to support themselves, and at a certain point actually to be able to get off the grid if necessary. Mm-hmm. And I urge you the next time you go to Easton, it really is a very, very interesting place to visit, and I thank you. There were a lot of people who helped set up that trip, and I appreciate it.
Very good.
Yeah, it's fascinating.
Any other questions on the Secretary's agenda?
No. Move approval.
Second.
Thank you.
All in favor. General Services.
Well, good morning, Lieutenant Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Ellington Churchill, Secretary for the Department of General Services. The Department has 33 items on our agenda today, including one supplemental. Also note that we have five new grantees as a part of our agenda, and we're happy to answer any questions you may have at this time.
I don't, but you have a number of guests here.
Yes, sir. We have members of the Maryland Science Center, including Mark Potter, CEO of the Maryland Science Center, and some of his staff.
Mr. Potter, come on down.
This is item 23.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Madam Treasurer, Mr. Rich Poehler, Governor. I'm Mark Potter, President and CEO of the Maryland Science Center. Along with many members of our staff behind me, I stand before you today to ask you to approve funds for the conversion of our IMAX theater to digital technology. While we are a private nonprofit, we have always enjoyed a unique partnership with the state of Maryland. Indeed, without this partnership, the Science Center would not exist. With your help, the Science Center has become the leading provider of STEM education across the state, and no other institution reaches more teachers and students in Maryland than the Science Center with STEM education, both inside our building and outside through our outreach efforts across the state in every county. Today, I am here specifically to ask you to support a grant for our IMAX Theater. This grant will enable us to fulfill our dream to convert the theater from film-based to digital projection. With this conversion, we will enjoy substantial operational savings. And as few movies today are film-based, digital will allow us to screen popular films, providing increased revenue to our bottom line. And most importantly, converting to digital will allow us to take advantage of the vast and growing library of mission-based IMAX documentary films. With your approval today, we look forward to converting the theater in January. We hope to be completed by March, and we hope that you can join us for the March reopening. Thank you again for your continued commitment to Maryland's Science Center. With the support of the state, we continue to celebrate science every day for the people of Maryland. Thank you. Thank you, Secretary Churchill.
Yeah. What are you going to do with the old projector?
I don't know
what projector means. Yeah. So.
IMAX actually comes and takes pieces of it so it can't be used again, and then the rest is disposed of.
Sad.
Yeah. I know.
Yeah.
I actually have a turntable in my attic, maybe.
Those are coming back.
Those are back. I'll tell you, my daughter bought this little portable turntable, which is just like one that my sisters had back in the late 60s. So, and records... regular records, like $20 to buy an LP, as they used to be called. If you remember an LP, long play. It all comes back. Oh yeah. Well, the analog hits highs. Digital cuts them off. If you look at the sound waves, digital cuts off the highs, so you don't get the pure sound that you do. But you also get the cracking. And with the record on.
So I appreciate your invitation, and I'm sure we'll be there.
Yeah.
We're going to open our first documentary film will be A Beautiful Planet, which is a beautiful IMAX film.
Okay. We want to keep the projector, though. Put it in a museum or something. Because at some point we'll go back to film.
Right.
You know, we'll
right.
go back to everything. Right. So, all right. So thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you all for your great work.
Not only
with the schools, but all the rest of us who were in school years ago, but still love your museum.
Yeah. We appreciate that.
Yeah. So what time is it open?
10 o'clock.
Oh, okay. So you got time to get back to work then. Or maybe not. Oh, they wanted to do a photo with the...
Could I just say something also before we do the Science Center photo? Because Science Center is a great project, and we have a long list of these capital grants.
Yes.
And I just wanted to highlight also the Young Women's Christian Association of Annapolis and Anne Arundel County. They were the recipient of my William Donald Schaefer Helping People Award. And I think we can all agree that the important work, maybe we should do the photograph first.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Okay.
Then we can go
for that. Let's do that.
Governor, why don't you have a seat? And, sir, why don't you have a seat? Ma'am, have a seat.
Okay.
Everybody moving real close. Vertically challenged should be in the front row.
Shorter but smarter.
You know, I agree 100%.
But you're standing on a
wow.
Top.
No, I'm not. Do me a favor, guys. Hide those bottles of water. Not that it's that big of a deal. Okay. Three shots. I need you to smile. Hold it. Make it good. Thank you. Governor, if it's okay,
yes,
I just wanted to comment that there's a long list of these capital grants led by the Science Center, which I think is a tremendous recipient. But I also mentioned the YWCA here in Anne Arundel County, which is receiving $1 million for new domestic violence and trafficking shelters.
Yeah.
These are capital dollars, not operating dollars, in Anne Arundel County. And I also see that the National Aquarium in Baltimore City will be receiving $2 million for their new Animal Care and Rescue Center. I just want to compliment John Racanelli and his entire team at the aquarium for their environmental conservation work. They do terrific work in that area. And there's $3 million for Strathmore Hall for much-needed enhancements to its campus in Montgomery County, including improvements to the concert hall and the mansion. And obviously, as everyone knows from Montgomery, that institution plays a pivotal role in the arts and culture of Montgomery County. Those are just a few more of the additional worthy projects in addition to the Science Center. I obviously, along with you, Lieutenant Governor, and Treasurer Kopp, we strongly support these items. I would like to just finish on one particular item, which is item 32. This is an item for repayment to the state of funding received by the East Baltimore Community Corporation. And it's my understanding that the project that this organization received these funds already for did not come together as planned. Given the magnitude, however, of the opiate crisis in our state that is destroying the lives of countless Marylanders across the state, including families and communities in East Baltimore, where this organization is located. Lieutenant Governor, as you know better than most of us, funding is critically needed for organizations like the East Baltimore Community Corporation, which provides treatment services for those plagued by this crisis. So therefore, I'd like to make a motion to waive the repayment of $87,470 and allow this outstanding organization to use these funds to continue the incredible and life-saving work they do each and every day. And I know that's a little unusual, but it's within the power of the board to waive that repayment obligation
And if we were ever going to do it, this is one organization that truly deserves it.
Well, it is something that is needed in terms of, you know, funding for the associated with the opioid crisis and heroin epidemic that we've been facing. My concern with taking this approach is a little bit of the precedent that we set. While we do have the authority to do it, there are other funds available that we could possibly explore to supplement or put in place of this funding. We were recently from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services awarded a large grant, the SOAR grant funding. We're in the process now with our Department of Health determining exactly how we're going to allocate those funds. It's several million dollars over a couple of years, and this would be a worthy organization to consider utilizing some of those funds that could be done in place of this $87,000. So if we want to defer this item, I don't know if that's necessary to do that, to explore, give us an opportunity to explore what we can do through the SOAR funding to replace it. But they sound like they would be a worthy candidate for funding. Because one of the things that we're trying to push as we go through this analysis of how to utilize the funds is we don't want the funds to, and I'd be brutally honest, we don't want the funds to just get utilized in the overhead of our Department of Health, that we push as much out to the local authorities and particularly the grassroots organizations that are really meeting people and tend to have much lower overhead than some of the larger organizations that, quite frankly, pay a lot of money to their executive directors and folks like that. That the grassroots organizations are hitting more people. So this would be the type of organization that we're looking for to provide funding that tend to have better return on their investment than what some of the larger ones do. And I don't want to trash all the large organizations out there, but we need to be able to get to the grassroots organizations. So I know that that's not the waiver and that's not the immediate. But
yeah, well, why don't we, I'm happy to change that based on your comments. I think they're appropriate. So why don't we just defer this to the next meeting in December?
Yeah,
if you have some research that shows, maybe we'll be able to return the $87,000 plus some extra money. So that would be great. And it's for only, I agree with you about the precedent, but I also completely agree with you that these small not-for-profits on the front lines do a tremendous amount of good with a very thin amount of resources.
Right. And often don't have the resources to go out and apply or track these types of the funds that are available. And so they don't necessarily have the people who come knocking on the door at the health department or other places saying, hey, we're here to apply for this grant. They don't know about it. And so it's just a way to get more information out there.
So I would be happy to move to defer this item and move approval of the other items.
Thank you.
I agree.
Right.
Great.
Yeah, thank you. I think all in favor. Thank you. General Services, thank you. So, Ellington, you can go home.
Can I just say a word? Following up on what all that has been said about this agenda, to all the folks watching this meeting, this particular General Services Administration touches all parts of the state, a range of different types of public purpose. It's a fascinating document, actually, to see what Maryland does with general funds. And I really urge people to take a look. I know everyone's here for their particular interest, but take a look at this whole agenda because it's really very interesting and not atypical of the sort of DGS agendas that we see.
Well,
we need a motion on the entire agenda, so we defer 32.
We have a motion. and I think all approve.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, General Services is the backbone of state government. And you do get to, and coming to the Board of Public Works, you do get to see the operations of government, and that's why I enjoy it. I don't know why a lot of governors historically have not really cared for it.
But you know what you're saying actually is the same thing Marvin Mandel said. That it was one of the most fascinating parts of being governor because you could see what was going on.
Yeah.
All the state and all the department.
Right. You get a chance to ask the direct questions because, you know, like, I don't know if you're in the way off topic, but if you listen to the Nixon tapes, you hear all the happy talk of the, you know, his staff talking about how wonderful things are. And it's the same thing as, you know, a governor, a lieutenant governor, your secretaries come in and tell you all this happy talk. And so this is the opportunity to really ask the questions of your folks where they're basically being recorded. It's, you know, in front of the public. It's transparent. To ask what the heck happened here. So I think it is good government at its best. And so we should be thankful we have that here in Maryland. Department of Natural Resources.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Lieutenant Governor Rutherford, and Mr. Comptroller. For the record, my name is Joanne Throw. I am Deputy Secretary for the Department, and for your consideration, I have 11 interesting items on the agenda, on the real property agenda, and I'm happy to take any questions you have. I also have several representatives in the room for any details.
Fascinating items. 5A.
How we're doing. 5A.
Yeah, 5A. Well, not just the various programs, the, you know, conservatory. There are a number of funds that are going to various projects under Program Open Space. Mm-hmm. The Howard Rawlings Conservatory renovation, which I've driven past several times. The parks are all wonderful projects that are well needed. But when you go to page 55, there's a typo that I happen to find. Program open space, and the space is not spelled correctly. So it's just the placement of the letters, purely a typo.
But sir, something. I appreciate you pointing that out.
You're
so
I know
well
you do.
Read. No, thank you. I appreciate it.
Mine does. Maybe yours is correct. Mine wasn't. Okay.
55 and 56. So it looks like two of the four pages have the heading incorrect. That will be corrected.
Yep.
As soon as it appears with its approval circles on the internet this afternoon, it will be fixed.
58.
Oh, your pages are okay. Any other questions?
No, but just to point out all of those, starting with the Howard. Howard P. Rawlings, I hope it says, conservatory renovations. But the whole, all that's happening at Druid Hill Park and Clifton Park, I think, is going to be a really exciting project once we finish.
Absolutely. Thank you for
putting that. Would DNR seriously on number one, we will insert P, that DNR is Howard P. Rawlings.
Yes.
Good with that?
Yes.
We will remember Howard P.
It will be addressed.
Thank you.
Oh. Out of park improvements.
Thank you.
Okay, so we have a motion. We're all in favor, or it's approved. Department of Budget and Management.
Good morning, Governor, Mr. Comptroller, Madam Treasurer. For the record, Mark Nicole, Deputy Secretary of the Department of Budget Management. The department has submitted 7 items for today's agenda. We are withdrawing item 7S, and we will be bringing it back to the board at the December 5th meeting. We have representatives here to answer any questions you may have.
Item 3S, State Board of Elections. Do we have anyone here for that?
We do. Linda Lamone is here, Director of the Board of Elections.
Good morning.
Good morning.
For the record, Linda Lamone, Administrator of Elections, and Mr. Charleston, my deputy. Thank you very much.
Well, this item is really for staffing assistance, I guess, for the next election.
Yes.
And so, I guess, you bring them on at some point, I guess, prior. They're not coming on right now. Correct?
No, they're not. This is just a renewal of the contract option year.
Okay, very good. But I do have some questions about last week's election and the process. There's some confusion in terms of what took place and why the some polls didn't close until 2 hours later, and there was some confusion in terms of the release of results, where counties were releasing results, but we weren't getting state results, and the networks were looking kind of strange and getting information from different places. Can you walk us through what may have happened last sure. Tuesday with that?
First of all, I'd like to congratulate you and the controller for your reelection.
Thank you.
And just to give you all a little bit of background here, we had over 2 million mailers vote in this general election, about 1.5 of them on election day. So it was a busy day around the state. We had voting until at least 9 o'clock, sometimes later, in Baltimore County at the Towson Library, Charles County in Waldorf, Montgomery County at the Silver Spring Library, and then in Prince George's County was the latest to finish voting. And also want to remind everyone that it is inappropriate to release the results of the election when people are still voting. That has been, perhaps you recall, a debate back in the 1980s, even earlier, about what the networks were doing.
The West Coast,
releasing,
right?
Yeah. So it my decision, I made it, I take responsibility for it. I instructed all the local boards to hold their early voting results until after I released the results, and some did and some didn't. So Baltimore County, for example, just went ahead and posted them.
Mm-hmm. Linda, it was my understanding, and I may be wrong, that Baltimore and Montgomery put them up but then took them down. Is that...
Montgomery did that. Yeah.
Montgomery did.
Yeah. I don't know about Baltimore.
Because they apparently had not gotten the word, though I would think it's common sense, that you don't put them up until all the polls had closed.
It was, a staff person in Baltimore County, and the election director didn't get to him in time to say, don't do it. It's a mistake. No. So we had over 2,000 voting locations, over 20,000 poll workers. It's a pretty big operation on Election Day. And those 20,000 poll workers are the people that actually are the backbone of our elections, as you all know. So Prince George's County is, I guess, the focus of attention here.
Well, let me just go back. I guess it's the Montgomery County question or Baltimore County, whichever one it was, that posted early. But they wouldn't necessarily know that, say, Prince George's County was having a problem, right? If Montgomery County is feeling that they're all...
They were told by the Board of Elections.
Yeah, we were... Everybody was following the news. Of course, the press was going nuts over the Prince George's County situation. And we were advising the local election directors as to what was going on.
Okay. So, but at 8 o'clock, you know, Prince George's County or someplace their polls have already, so you're telling them beforehand. You told them before 8 o'clock that hold off until we talk to you.
Yes.
Okay. I'm just thinking logistically that how would the local precinct or whatever know, but unless you told them earlier. Okay. Continue.
It happened.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly what happened in Prince George's County yet. We're still trying to gather the information because they're still canvassing ballots, and they're busy. They're doing their final they're doing provisionals today, and they'll finish up the absentees on Friday. We do have information that we've been able to get from our systems that tell us, for example, how many scanners were in each polling place of the identified ones. The last time that someone checked in, and then the last time, the time the last ballot was cast. So we are able to track that. It's very strange because in Precinct 9-3, which is the Evan Elementary School, there's only 540 voters assigned to that polling place. Only 144 of them showed up, but yet there was a gap of 45 minutes when they weren't voting any paper ballots. So they had run out of ballots. And we're trying to figure out why. Did they have a lot of, it was a three-page ballot in Prince George's County.
Right.
Did they have a lot of people spoil their ballots? So they had to reissue them. And if that hadn't happened, they probably would have had enough ballots. But we simply don't know the answer yet.
Yeah, but how do you, who determines how many ballots go to a precinct? And how many would you send a ballot for all 400 and whatever it is, eligible voters?
Typically, no.
Okay, I would think because you
know. We do an analysis based on past turnout as to the number of ballots we think each polling place needs. Mm-hmm. And we that's sort of the, I guess, the minimum, and we give that to the local boards of elections, and they are free to, because there's nothing to require them to adhere to what we say, to adjust that amount. But we don't know yet how Prince George's County adjusted it. And to her credit, she's tried to get more ballots out to the polling places when she learned that there were shortages. But as you remember, the weather was awful that day, and people hadn't shown up in the morning, so they were showing up in the afternoon, and it was during rush hour. And rush hour in Prince George's County, Beltway, can be pretty brutal.
Yeah, but 140, you said 142 showed up, actually?
144.
44 voted out of the 400 and...
540.
500.
Mm-hmm.
That's strange. Like you
yeah,
said,
it really is.
That's strange. Very low turnout, which is somewhat surprising.
Yeah, 26, about 27%. One of the lowest. And so I'll be happy to get back with you all when we get some more information from Prince George's County. We just haven't been able to get anything else.
So just understanding the process, they will order a certain amount of ballots. You give a recommendation in terms of, based on prior and probably some assumptions of maybe increased turnout, and then they order a number. Do you know what that number is when they order?
I'm Nikki Charlson with the State Board of Elections. So we actually have the contract for printing the ballots.
Okay.
And so we work with the counties. We give them an initial estimate. This is what you think you should order. We go back and forth a little bit. And so we know what the order is by ballot style.
Mm-hmm.
And then when they're delivered to the local boards of elections, they then break them down to each precinct to deploy out to each location.
Okay. So
she had enough ballots.
Yeah.
They just weren't deployed.
Oh, they okay. They weren't. Okay. All right. You know, just looking at your side of whether you say, you know, like you said, the point is you make a recommendation, then they come back and say we want a little bit more or we want a little bit less. But then it's up to.
It's always more.
Okay.
And then they divide up what they receive into the precincts.
Okay. So it sounds like they should have had the appropriate number. It's just a question of what happened.
I don't think it will happen again.
Yeah. It wasn't machine problems, was it?
No.
Okay.
Were there significant machine problems this year?
How many do we have? Do we know?
I think the preliminary count from election day is about 10 to 12. So we're still collecting that data from the local election officials, but the equipment seemed to perform quite well.
How did they decide in terms of that polling place? It was just one polling place that stayed open until 10 o'clock
no,
or whatever?
It was about 35 of them.
Were they all in the same county?
Yep.
Well, that doesn't sound good at all. Sounds like there was some real problems there. Now, how did they determine who, you know, at 8 o'clock, who was in line? Were they all in the building at that time? I mean, you know, like at the grocery store, the cashier says, you're the last person, hold on to this or put this behind you or whatever.
See, that's generally what happens. They give the last person in line a piece of paper or something to hold.
But do they make sure they're in the building versus standing outside?
Because it depends on the polling place, Governor.
Because that's, I mean, that I do feel most people are honorable, but someone can walk up. If you're the person holding this sheet of paper and some menacing person comes up to you and says, I want to get in line, you're not going to be the gatekeeper, you know, or I'm not going to be the gatekeeper. So, no one behind me, you know, you can't vote. And it's like, give me the sheet of paper. Okay, so.
Pass it on, yeah.
So there's no way of telling. I mean, it's one thing if they're in the building. I can.
Right.
So that's an easy thing. You can lock the door and say, sorry, you're too late, you didn't make it. But, you know, if you're open until 10 o'clock, you know, and people think, hey, someone sitting at home or unscrupulous people get on the phone and say, hey, you need to get down here, blah, 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 blah. And it may not affect the statewide, but it could affect the local, you know, elections. We saw in the primary where people won or lost by 6 or 11 votes. So in Virginia, there was
now.
A coin toss, you know, so... Mm-hmm. That's something we probably should take a closer look at how they decide when you have these errors or problems and people can't vote that want to vote and legitimately should be able to vote, but then, you know, you have this grouping that could be lined up outside and then you have no way of knowing who's getting in line, who's, but they just shouldn't be, you know, they missed their time. And we have early voting. So it sounds like 25% early voting, or 25% of the people who voted early.
Yeah.
Okay. But that's still an increase from 2 years and 4 years ago.
It's the busiest. The 2016 general election early voting was the only busier time we've had.
And that's presidential.
Right.
Okay. So the percentage increase from 14 to now was approximately what? Do you know? Approximately?
10%?
10%. Oh, that's not as
overall,
much.
I think probably in the 2014 election, general election, about 15% of turnout was early voting. And we were.
And so now we're at 25%.
So that's what I mean by the 10% of
turnout. But the total, in the end, was the total turnout that much more this year?
Well, their ballots are still being counted, so
we don't
have final turnout yet.
Hmm. Yeah, I've seen different numbers in the press, but you know, they are probably talking to different people. There's been between 55% and
55% on we think around 55% on election day.
Okay.
Compared to what?
Oh, in the 40s.
So early voting, the actual universe of people voting expanded.
Yes.
It wasn't just people going from election day to early voting.
Correct.
I don't know. I mean, some of the numbers that we saw, and of course these are internal numbers, is that 90% of the early voters voted before. So it was a 10% had not voted before.
Right.
Yeah, 90% of the early voters had already voted. 70% of them had voted early last time. So it's more people are voting and more people are voting early. Okay.
The question always was, is it just going to shift it and not add to the bottom line the number of people voting?
Yeah. I think it's doing more shifting than adding. This was just a good turnout. Even though 55% to me does not sound that great, and I meant 45% just, you know, changed out their sock drawer or something instead of voting. And particularly that one precinct where you only had 145 out of 500 plus, you know, eligible voters. That is really frightening in terms of.
But it was an interesting election. I think all of us would agree. And there were issues in long lines and delayed closings and reporting in several states, at least a half a dozen.
Hmm.
There were a lot of people out there.
Yeah.
Well, and going back to the early voting, and I'm going to tie you up too much longer, but. Had there been thought of maybe adding a few more voting sites for early voting? Because I noticed that there are a lot of places, and maybe it wasn't as spread out. A lot of people ran out on Thursday and Friday, and I think people didn't realize they could go out on Sunday and vote. So Sunday kind of died down a little bit. But, you know, some counties, I think, you know, one or more additional sites might be something at least to explore.
Is that in the law?
It is
in law. They
so
specify, which is silly, you know, because it doesn't give you that flexibility when you say, oh, it has to be at this location and that location. And I know we don't have the schools to be able to do it.
Right, the schools for early voting, and of course some of the local governments don't want anymore because it costs them.
Yeah, there's a There's a cost associated. Okay. All right. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so the contract is for $6.3 million for 2 years. It's an option contract for something called a group called 22nd Century Technologies in Somerset, New Jersey. What exactly do these folks do?
So 22nd Century is the recruiting firm. They have a MBE and a VSBE to help them with recruitment, but they helped us recruit about 400, well, they helped us recruit and replace 420 individuals to support the selection. It's a surge staffing contract. We've had something like this in place for many, many elections because the local boards don't have the permanent staff to conduct the election. And so these people come in when they're needed, and then they go away when the election is over.
Are they at the precincts, many of them?
So there are some out in the field called election field support, and they are roving between a set number of precincts, so they're on the ground if they need help. But they're not assigned to a specific, there's not one in every precinct. They have a cluster of precincts that they support.
So what happened, what was the inconvenience for thousands of voters in Baltimore County? What was that all about? Baltimore County?
Towson University?
Yeah. What was the problem up there?
They had... that precinct has a lot of college students that come, and they have to vote provisionally, and that process takes longer. I just was told this morning some of the numbers from that precinct. It was extraordinarily high number of provisionals, and so that was what the delay was in Baltimore County for the general.
What about Charles County?
Charles County was just a very busy precinct. Yeah. We saw very high turnout in early voting in Charles County, so I don't think there was any specific issue that triggered that delay in Charles County. They just had some high turnout in Charles County.
When is this report that you mentioned going to be ready? As to what happened and what exactly is going to be done to correct the problem? Because every election, something like this is happening. I feel like we're living in Florida.
Oh, come on.
Really? I mean, this is not acceptable. And I for one, I mean, I remember what happened in Baltimore County with lack of scanners. Now it's lack of ballots. And I hope that at some point someone is going to be held accountable somewhere, somehow, for the situation that occurred in this election, which was an embarrassment. Really?
Comptroller, I couldn't disagree more.
Hang on a minute, Madam Treasurer, if I could just express myself. This is something that should not happen in Maryland, ever. And it seems to happen every single election. So could you please get a report done? I'm surprised it isn't done already because it's more than a week. And secondly, could you please make some heads roll somewhere, somehow, so someone feels as if there is accountability? Thank you.
Ms. Lamone, I think this election went very well. One of the very good things was that a lot of people came out to vote. Sometimes that takes longer than anticipated, because we didn't know it, and you didn't have enough people at some of the polls, I bet, but we're waiting to hear the reports from the counties as to what caused problems. But this was a very smooth election. It not at all, I believe, like Florida or Georgia, and not like some we've had in the past. And I don't know what people have been reading, what they're alluding to. And I do hope that we will find whatever problems there are, because there are always some problems, and correct them. But I just want to go on record saying I think that this election in Maryland went very smoothly with some glitches, mostly attributable to a large number of people wanting to come out and vote.
Well, that's exactly why we never correct these problems, because everything is just, oh, it's just fine. It isn't fine.
The fact that there aren't enough ballots at a polling place is completely unacceptable.
Agreed.
The fact that you have to, on national TV, put out a call to tell all the local jurisdictions not to report the results, that's a humiliation for the state. We should not have that. It was not a several small glitches. The entire election result was put on hold. You're in charge of it. You folks are the overall folks. You've got the county people underneath you. If some people do not lose their jobs because of this, shame on you.
I don't have any authority over it.
No, well, you should put together a report that demands that there be some changes. Because every election cycle, this is happening in Maryland. And it's wrong. So, anyway, said my piece.
Yeah.
And I hope that you'll get the report back to us and to the legislature. And I hope that there will be some accountability in it, because this was, it's just, when you say that it's not going to happen again, that's what we hear every 4 years. And last time, I think it was lack of scanners in Baltimore County. Really? We can't get the proper scanning machines there? So, anyway, onward and upward. But this is not a good situation, and I hope the report is promptly done and submitted. I hope that we get it.
I'd like to see that as well.
Thank you.
I do have some concerns based on my questions. I have some concerns, and we will be approaching a presidential. I would expect there's going to be a larger turnout than what we saw even 2 years ago. And so we need to be prepared and make sure the locals are prepared for this. It is very troubling, particularly that one jurisdiction that, you know, that they only had 145 people turn out, and the poll was held open for 2 additional hours. And like I said, the whole question of how do you determine who the last person is in line is just something that we can't really abide by. And it didn't look good nationally, that numbers weren't coming out, and where the networks, based on probably the early reporting numbers from Montgomery County,
which should not have come
were
out.
Already saying what they thought the election was, but then everyone is kind of in limbo. On a personal note, I vote at Hammond High School in Howard County, the turnout there, and I voted typically for the last 20-plus years at 7 o'clock in the morning, because a lot of people in my neighborhood go to Washington, and if you're not on the road by 7 o'clock, you're going to take you a lot longer than normal. It was a much longer line than I've ever seen. And I think part of it was the fact that there was just the one scanner. There were less polling booths there. So you need to talk to the locals to say, you know, and this, the turnout was probably a little higher, but not higher than what presidentials are. And it just, I don't think they were prepared for what was going on. And we need to get information to those locals that they need to do a better job. Not just in Howard County, where we're not hearing the kinds of problems of Prince George's or Baltimore County or Charles. But we need to be prepared for what I would expect to be a big surge in the next 2 years.
I agree. It's very frustrating to me not to be able to correct the problems directly. Yes.
Okay.
It's from the people like you.
Yeah. I'd like to see the report, like you said, because then we can talk to the locals, their local officials, to say, look, this shouldn't happen. Something needs to be done, and making sure that your organization is providing the guidance and the support that they need as well.
And has the legal authority. No, I don't disagree that we have to be prepared for a very large turnout in 2 years. I think that's going to be a very serious problem. I also am very concerned with the two jurisdictions, major jurisdictions, that reported returns before the polls were closed in the state, because I am sure that as it happened in the 80s, when they reported what happened in the East, and people read it in California, didn't go to the polls, right, that it does discourage mm-hmm. people.
Why bother?
Yeah, and I'm chagrined that Montgomery County did that, Baltimore County did that. I hope they won't do it again.
I would use a different word to describe myself.
Well, so. I mean, that really is interference with the outcome.
Okay.
Not that Prince George's County ever looks at what Montgomery County did and decides to vote that way. I don't
know. Well, you never know. Unfortunately.
Well.
Any other questions?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I have no more questions on that agenda.
I have item one.
Oh, okay. Item one.
We have Ann Timmons, our Director of Employee Benefits, here to answer any questions you may have.
Excellent. You have the chair of the State Retirement Agency and the vice chair here, so we're well aware of what the importance is of the services outlined. I guess I have, and this may be repetitive, but Siegel Company, which we're awarding this contract to, had the top-ranked technical proposal, but the more expensive price proposal. The other bid submitted by Baltimore-based Bolton Partners had a financial proposal that was nearly $2 million lower than the recommended vendor submitted by, I guess, the agency and the department. So since the department determined that Bolton Partners was capable of performing the services required in the contract, why, tell me again why they were not awarded the contract, given the significantly lower price that they bid?
Certainly. So the state contract, we are complex. We are demanding. We need the highest level of expertise that we can get. Siegel has provided that well and faithfully under the current contract. They have a data warehouse that they currently houses 7 years of our claims and eligibility data that allows them to provide any manner of ad hoc reporting. Helps them when we are in the legislative session to turn around fiscal notes on a dime. Other states may allow a 2 to 3 day turnaround. We often have a 24-hour turnaround on our fiscal notes. They're able to accommodate that. Their depth and breadth of professionalism, they're recognized leaders. They're a national company. We are able to have resources that are located in Atlanta, New York, D.C. Their compliance practice leader is nationally recognized. And their actuarial expertise is also nationally recognized. And as we build our budgets for the Employee and Retiree Health Fund, they are extremely critical to that process.
So there's a 30%, approximately 30% increase from the previous contract for the same number of years. What is that attributable to?
That's really attributable to undervaluing on the current contract. There was a slight increase on the hourly rates for the various consultants that resulted in that part of that increase.
Okay, thank you very much, and obviously these are essential services for our folks.
I have a question. Doesn't the state own the data? You talked about a data warehouse of the information, so the state owns that data.
Correct.
So that data could be transferred to another entity.
It could be.
So that shouldn't be the biggest factor that you weigh into it, because it is our data. If we can say transfer that data in this format to this entity or to do it, you know.
Certainly. But they also, in that data warehouse, they contain other states' similar claims and eligibility experience that allows them to benchmark what we're doing against other states, which is very helpful to
us. And Bolton doesn't have that, Brett?
Not at this time. We would have been their first state contract.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
Any other questions for budget management?
No, move approval.
Okay, second, and all approved. Thank you. University System of Maryland.
Good morning. Joe Evans, representing the University System of Maryland. We have five items on the agenda. In attendance, we have Senator Andrew Serafini, who is here on item 2LT. We're here to answer any questions.
Maybe the senator should come up and address us on Hagerstown and explain why I'm going to pay more rent per square foot for less space.
Yes, definitely. Thank you. Certainly glad to be here after that question. So, if it was easy, anybody could do it. So first of all, thank you all. It's an honor to be before you all. I'm going to try to be brief, but I do want to talk about these. And there's two issues here I want to talk about. So I definitely want to address the lease part first. And then we haven't come here for some of the recent approvals for funding for what we're calling the urban improvement project. So I would like to give you an update on that after we talk about the main issue of why we're here. So to understand, there's three components to what we're calling the urban improvement project, and the idea was multiple use of same spaces. So currently, students at the Barbara Ingram School go over, and for 160 days a year, they use the performing stage at Maryland Theater. Well, that's great for those students, but that means the theater cannot book those times, and that's a revenue for them. So part of the Barbara Ingram expansion is that those times would be freed up for the Maryland Theater to do that. When we talked about USMH originally, it was only for a hospitality, and it was going to be on the first floor. That was a need. It's going to help UMES if we understand the issues there, and it's something because of our hospitality, because of the crossroads of 70 and 81, was going to be very, very important, very simple. But as we started in the project, it became very clear that we were going to build two labs for students, STEM labs, at both the high school, and we need this as we're starting a physician's assistant program. We're going to talk about a nurse practitioner program. It's at Frostburg now, but we're bringing. And there's a great demand in our community for that third and fourth year for affordability, right? Why do we have regional centers if we can't offer a wide variety? The nursing program is exploding from Towson up in our area. So the thought was, why would we build two labs that were only 100 yards apart? So we put the brakes on the hospitality. We said, can we go into the second floor of this building that is right across from the current USMH building? And we said that would be great. The students could come across. We could do dual enrollment. It could be used, and it could be helped instead of having two different. Now, I should say to you, Barbara Ingram, the only eligibility requirements are your talents. In other words, I would never have been accepted into that school. So there's no academic requirements, which I wouldn't have been accepted for that either. But although there's no academic requirements, it has been 7th and 10th in the state for academics. Because you understand the power of both sides of the brain, that's what we find in front of us creative people. So the idea was to build a bridge for security for the students to pass back and forth. And understand that's a two-way bridge. The students during the day could come over and use the labs at USMH. And at night, USMH students could use some of the classrooms. We're building a 50,000-square-foot school. And how great not for USMH and further expansion have to build something new, just use those spaces in the evening. Well, the bridge originally was $300,000 as an estimate. It came in at $1 million, and it kept climbing. And also, the school system was going to pay a $40,000 lease a year to use that. They started saying, we can build our own labs. It's always cheaper to go up than it is out. And so that's when the change came. Now, the idea of why are we paying more, the original bid, and it was a bid, it was not a sign, but what brought you was for the developer to rough out, we would say, and then the lab space and all that other, it would not be finished space. That's the difference in the square-footed cost. I have provided you some other leases in that area, so you will know that this lease rate is, we have other state agencies in the area that are paying those kind of rates, so we find that it is affordable. Now, the other side is, There's a question of was there structural problems and was a developer asking the state to pay for those. That's what the Board of Regents and their finance department looked at. That clearly has been separated out. They are not asking the system or the state in this case to pay those extra dollars. I'd like to think that I'm a fiscally conservative person. I would never come to you with something that I felt that was over the top or not within reason. So I'll stop there before I give you a little update on UAP and ask, answer any questions if you have them.
Well, thank you. That was a very good explanation, and I see why you were reelected. And congratulations.
Originally, I was unopposed, which meant I needed one vote. And my wife said, you better go work on that one. So, unfortunately, my mother lives in the district, so that was my only shot. So if I can, and I'll try to be brief here, I want to talk to you about the urban improvement because we haven't come, and I want you to have an update. In your packet, you have some of this. I'm just going to pick the highlights, too. So first of all, we want to say thank you. Our community is saying thank you to the Board of Public Works because you have come alongside of us and you have worked with us. But I want to be clear from the very beginning. We never asked for a handout. We never even asked for a hand up. We asked for a partner in this. And we said we would come together and work with you. We would create an odd coalition in our state, these days, with a city, a county, state delegation. Our community people have come together in a big way with this. The governor said to us, he said, this is not going to solve the problems of Hagerstown. It is only going to be that flame as it starts to burn, and we understand that. So as part of that, you all have approved up to this point parts of the governor's $7.5 million commitment to this program. That we've also had DHCD in for about $2 to $2.5 million, and the new school, the Barbara Ingram expansion, that's a little over $10 million. Now, the city, county, and federal government have matched the governor at $7.5 million. And now what we're finding most important is the other activity that the governor talked about. We have to date, and more is coming, $16.5 million committed to our urban core from private developers. That's the outside coming. And saying thank you, we see you, we'll raise that. And, in fact, they did. I want to highlight two things for you. Now, this hospitality program, as we talked to, when it came, our local people came and said, we're thankful for an expansion of the regionals because it means so much for us, for our kids to be able to stay here, live at home if they have to for affordability, and get degrees. As part of that, we started the physician's assistant program. And when we did that, the local hospital had a facility that they had used, and they came and said, we'll put $400,000 in the building, we'll give you a lease rate of $1 a year, and then local business people came in and raised privately over $1.5 million for that physician's assistant. And I will tell you, I've seen the performance on that, and the cash flow back to the system is as much as $500,000 or more positive when you take the expenses and everything and the tuition and weigh them out. That's going to be a positive cash flow back to the system. The second part is the Barbara Ingram School. The original Barbara Ingram School, only public-private partnership in the state for education. This has created tremendous efficiencies, as I talked about, as they're going to use the Maryland Theater Program and they're going to come over to USMH. And for Senator Rosa Pep, I haven't gotten as far as he wants me to, but the total cost per student is about $46,000 for those programs versus the state average is closer to $80,000 per student if you look at Allegheny and Frederick High School. We've shown the state a more efficient way to deliver education by using efficiencies across the state and really speaking to what our community needs and a different way, a 21st century way, to build schools. So we haven't come here in the past, but we want to tell you how much we appreciate this. This is my opportunity to tell you what we think we're doing, and we want you to know we've always said we see ourselves as a pilot in some of these things, but we're sharing this information down into Baltimore, into Prince George's County, and across the state because we think we've learned some things. We're telling what we did wrong, because we have, and we're also telling them how this has worked, and we just wanted to say to you, sorry for such a long discussion here, but we appreciate what you do, and I hope you see that our community really wants to work to reflect that appreciation the way we come around and try to raise ourselves up out of any issues that we have.
Thank you very much.
Yes, sir.
I just want to thank Senator Serafini for being a great champion of Western Maryland and Washington County and Hagerstown. Thank you for your advocacy. And what does Rosa Pep have to do with it?
Kind of like what Love has to do.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. We definitely don't have enough time for that, so I'll leave it there.
Good answer.
All the best. Yeah. Hey, how did your wife vote?
She did.
I still don't know.
Senator, just to add to this and the question of Senator Rosenfeld, too. I think you are building now the basis for coming back for an argument on school construction costs.
Yes.
And as opposed to just sort of theoretical.
Yes.
Or and clearly one thing that you're pointing out is it depends on the particular situation in a particular location. But I think I agree it's very important because now we really have something to deal with and not just assumptions.
Theory.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. And I served on the 21st Century School Construction for 2 years.
Yes.
By the way, I did not volunteer for that service. President Miller told me I was on it.
The senator serves on a lot of things.
Yeah.
He didn't volunteer.
And I would say to you,
thank you.
You know, I appreciate your questions. You all have to ask these hard questions, right? There are some things that government should do, but when they do them, they should do them as efficiently as possible. And anything that's an impediment to bringing that to our citizenry, and yet respecting the taxpayer, we must have a conversation. I appreciate your support in that. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Yeah, have a good day.
All right. I don't have any more
of approval.
Madam, anything else on the university system?
I didn't.
I think we have second, favorable. We're all in favor. Thank you. Department of Information and Technology.
Good morning, Governor, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller. For the record, I'm Mike Leahy, Secretary of the Department of Information Technology. Today we have 5 items on your agenda, and I do have agency representatives available to answer any questions.
I have a quick question on 3IT, the modification on that one.
Yes, sir. Mr. Schrader.
May it please the Board, my name is Dana Dembra, Director of Procurement for the Department of Health. With me is a team of 4 individuals who manage Medicaid information system for the Department of Health. They are Dennis Schrader, our Chief Operating Officer and Director of Medicaid. They also include Craig Smalls, who's the Assistant CIO in charge of the Medicaid operation, and John Bonds, the Director of Administrative Services, and Alex Peralta, who's the Senior Project Manager. This is a request for nearly $6 million to extend the contract for Cognosante to continue the planning of our transformation of MMIS from the old monolithic failed system known as MERC to the new incoming modularization system. We'll be happy to respond to questions.
Now, I understand that the first contractor that was brought in to assist failed.
CSC, yes, sir, and was sued by the Attorney General successfully.
Okay. All right. And so we use their performance bond to pay for part of what's going forward?
I think the Attorney General recovered about $80 million from that breach of contract.
Oh, okay.
And Treasurer, Governor, Comptroller Dennis Schrader, Chief Operating Officer, we actually, in collaboration with the Attorney General, recovered $81 million. $31 million went back to CMS because they share in the cost, and then we have $50 million that came back to our general fund, and we're working with DBM on the allocation of that recovery.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I just wanted to make sure that we could get our money back.
Yes, sir.
Okay. That was my only question.
Mr. Schrader, it's a great pleasure to see you there.
Madam Treasurer, good to see you. Thank you. I'm in the bowels of the organization. It's a big $13 billion operation. I feel like I'm in the Navy again. You know, we've got a boiler room.
It is a big operation. Thank you.
And
we'll be talking more, as I mentioned, the SOARS grant funding and how we're going to allocate that and not get caught up in the bowels of the organization. So, thank you. Any other questions?
No, move approval.
Second. I think we're all in favor. Department of Transportation.
Madam Treasurer, Mr.
Cobb. Give a second.
Okay.
Some of the people.
Well, we give a second. I just want to personally thank the Secretary of DeWitt for all that he's doing to help us.
It's our pleasure.
Many different ways. Thank you. It seems to be going well.
Nobody wants to stay for us.
Okay.
Good morning, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Comptroller, Governor. For the record, my name is Jim Ports. I'm Deputy Secretary of Operations for the Maryland Department of Transportation. and proud Marine Corps Sergeant.
Thank you for your service, too.
It's my honor. The Maryland Department of Transportation is presenting 17 items today. Item 17GM was submitted as a supplemental, and we stand ready to answer any questions you may have.
Just a comment on item number one in terms of the small preference program came into effect, and just for explanation, even though it's awarded to the higher bidder, it was within 5%. And so that
correct.
The small business was able to get.
We're listening.
That's good.
I take a moment to go off script just for a moment with the Amazon decision, which is great for the Washington region, which we're a part of. It's a benefit to us. But I saw a quote from or a comment from Steve Case, the former AOL, one of the AOL founders, who said something that I think resonated and something that we've been trying to work on the last 4 years, that if the states, and particularly our state, wasn't directing it at us, if we put a fraction of the effort and incentives into stimulating our small businesses and our startup businesses, we could see benefits greater than what Amazon would have been presenting over the next 10 to 15 years. And that's something that we've been trying to do, and I think it's a good opportunity now to really talk to our legislators and our Commerce Department and all to say, okay, there's a certain benefit that we're going to get because we're not expending the money that we were talking about expending, but we could focus a lot of that or a portion of that to our startup economy in parts of the state that are far less expensive than Northern Virginia and stimulate activity, economic activity, and businesses and startup businesses that could create eventually the next Amazon or the next Google or Apple or Under Armour or whoever it might be. So just wanted to make that comment. 6GM, the port contract, cost sharing, and this is on the island restoration. I think it's James and the Baron Island. Now, as I understand, some of the dredge spoils are going to be used, similar to Poplar Island and other places, to regenerate the islands. What size? I was told to the original size, but what is original? Yeah. I have a map in my office from 1794, and those islands are there.
They're huge.
And they're pretty good size.
Yeah, they are good size.
But that's based on when the Europeans came to the Chesapeake. So are you going back to, I'm not sure which group was there, if it was the Piscataways or the
let me ask Chris Curiel to come
up. The Powhatans and find out through, oral tradition what the actual size of that island might have been.
I guarantee Chris can probably answer for you.
Back to the Ice Age, the one.
Well, and therein lies the problem.
Could you introduce yourself, please?
Yes, sorry. Chris Coriel, Director of Harbor Development, MDOT, MPA, Madam Treasurer, Mr. Governor, Mr. Comptroller. So the problem is that it would be very difficult to go back and find the exact size of the island and where you determine the starting point. Was it in geologic time before us? Was it when the first European settlers came here? We don't know. The most recent chart that we have access to was from the oldest one was 1863. I'd love to see the 1794. And at that time, James Island was roughly 1,300 acres. So it is being developed as a environmental restoration, beneficial use of dredge material, and it will be 2,072 acres.
Okay. And that's James, or is that Baron?
That's James.
James. Okay. And Baron's?
Baron is roughly about 150 now. It was much larger before. Mm-hmm. We know in the 2002 time frame, we think it was about 200 acres, but it has suffered some erosion, as many of our islands across the bay have over the years.
I'll show you the map, because on the map, Baron is a little larger than James.
I can imagine.
Wow. Yeah.
That raises a question in my mind.
Sure.
They're obviously natural islands are changing all the time, but yes, particularly in the face of sea level rise and storm surge. How do you factor that in to your plans now as opposed to when we first did Poplar Island?
Well, actually, the Army Corps of Engineers requires that sea level rise be considered in project design, and so there are a couple things that are done. Number one, you design the dikes for the containment part of it so they're not overtopped by projected sea level rise.
And what projections are you using? The latest IPCC or what?
You know, I'm not sure. I'd have to get back to you on that. It's whatever the Corps specifies, since they're in charge of the design. They bring 65% of the money, so we go with their rules. So the other thing we do, and we've learned lessons at Poplar Island, because we've created wetlands with the Corps over there, and we work with the University of Maryland Center for Environmental Science, and we are definitely more than keeping up with sea level rise over there, and we'll continue to monitor that.
Because they just did up some of the projections for 20.
Yes.
I assume these islands are supposed to stay there for a while.
Well, absolutely they are, and we're looking to use James Island for more than 30 years for bay dredge material. So we have a vested interest in making sure it's there for the long haul.
We'll not only use it, but they still will be dredged materials after you stop.
Correct.
Adding to them, we don't really want to recirculate.
Right.
And I'm concerned because the numbers, I know that he's not there, but the Climate Change Commission are looking at are changing.
They are very challenging.
Are challenging and changing.
Yes.
And becoming more challenging. And the question, my question just is how you integrate all of this.
So the way we've done it at Poplar Island, and we are going to do this at James Island as well, there is an adaptive management plan that is based on monitoring of what's going on out at the island, as well as projections along with science that's developing over time. And so we're able to adapt how we're creating the habitat there.
That's good. And I'm glad that you're working with UMCEES.
Thank you. We have an excellent working relationship
That's
with
great.
Them. They have done a wonderful job for us.
Thank you.
Good. She's so good.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I don't have.
I have another item.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
To Lieutenant Governor, item 11, please. So we're being asked today to approve an additional $15.7 million. We're being asked to add that to an existing contract with Coach and Equipment Bus Sales for 720 paratransit vehicles. It's my understanding that these additional funds are needed to purchase the last 178 of the 720 paratransit vehicles because of the fact that Motorola has new radio equipment called 4G as opposed to the 3G in the other 542 buses or vehicles. It's my understanding that due to human error, the total contract amount was miscalculated due to options not being calculated for all anticipated vehicles. Now that we have the math correct and the accurate total amount now determined, I'm curious as to whether or not the current vendor would have been the lowest bidder if it weren't for a human error, or would one of the other vendors have been the lower bidder? I'm sorry if we didn't give that question to you in advance.
No, they didn't. But you're right on all accounts. It was a math error, and there was some radio enhancements with 3G to 4G. So you're correct on both counts. Maybe I can get Joe.
Yeah, but the 3G to 4G was $534,000. The other is $15 million.
Yeah. Right. No, I know. But there was a huge math error, too, in the original calculation.
Right.
That's where the biggest portion is.
Right.
But I want to recognize that the comptroller was correct on both accounts when he said both of those. Go ahead, Joe.
Good morning, for the record. My name is Joe Setatal. I'm the Acting Director of Procurement at the MTA. To answer your question, yes, the vendor would have still been awarded even with the calculation error.
Okay.
It was a line item error. We essentially took a line item that should have been multiplied and added it instead. So in reality, we're not, from a contractual standpoint, asking for more money. This is just the money that or contract authority that we should have asked for originally.
And that's a, is that one of these out-of-state consortiums that we're dealing with, or is that all on our own?
I'm sorry.
Are we purchasing these directly on our own, or is this through some kind of consortium?
My understanding is we're purchasing directly on our own.
Yeah.
And so,
state contract.
State contract, yes, sir.
So how, I guess I hate to ask how it occurred, the miscalculation, because I wasn't very good in math either, but is it
I actually thought about bringing a whiteboard just in case you asked.
Like with some stick figures. And,
goodness, you didn't. unfortunately, I don't want to laugh. What happened was, so everything was done on a unit price, and the initial portion of the contract, there was a base bus, you know, a cost it came out to, I believe, somewhere approximately $65,000. Then there were a variety of different options that could be added to the bus depending on what the end user initially wanted. And that totaled something around $80,000, just to use rough numbers. When you add the two up, it would obviously be $100,000+. When we did a line item for the entirety of the buses, rather than taking that total number and multiplying it by the number of buses, we took 399 of the base bus and one option. So instead of multiplying the option block 400 times, we did it once.
And this went to the feds, too? I mean, they pay most of it, don't they?
As of my understanding, no one has noticed it until just now. And unfortunately, I was able to find the bid tabulation form from back in the day, and it was in an Excel sheet, and it was a formula error. So, you know, always double-check your math.
Right? Yeah. Probably doing it by hand, you would have gotten it. Someone would have gotten it, but versus, like you said, it's in a form, so people are plugging numbers in.
Pen and paper is always best.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
it is 80-20 money, though.
Right.
You're right. Federal government.
Yeah. It's just, you know, frightening memories from college calculus where... I had one professor, and I did the formula correctly. He said, this is great. If you could only add, subtract, multiply, and divide, you'd be helpful. those professors, they can be blunt. That's when I decided law school was probably better.
Same.
Any additional questions on transportation? Thank you very much. We have a motion on transportation. Okay. We're all in favor. Thank you very much. And who was it from the port? The woman from the port. What was her name? Jim?
Jim.
Ms. Coriel. If you want to see that map, I'll show it to you. Just wait a moment.
That's pretty cool.